Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Ian Harrison. He's the president and CEO of Bipartisan Climate Action. That's a political action committee that supports Republican and Democratic incumbent members of Congress who will act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think you'll find that Ian Harrison makes a compelling case that bipartisanship here in the United States is possible, and further, it's necessary if we are to successfully do our part in remediating and adapting to climate change. Due to the length of our conversation, today's episode will be part one, so here we go. Ian Harrison, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thank you. Thanks, John.
Ian Harrison is president and CEO of Bipartisan Climate Action, which I believe is a political action committee. And so today we'd like to have some understanding from Ian's perspective of possibilities for collaboration between liberal, progressive, conservative, right-of-center folks on climate change mitigation adaptation. And also, we've got a great opportunity here to get Ian's perspective on what the next Congress might look like. So let's start off, Ian, by me asking, what is the mission of the Bipartisan Climate Action?
The mission is really straightforward. It's to pass significant and enduring legislation to reduce greenhouse gases. That's what we're advocating for. The method by which we do that is running a political action committee that provides campaign finance to members of Congress who are simply willing to pass significant and enduring legislation on a bipartisan basis. My job is very simple. It's to raise money for members of Congress and keep them in office, incumbent members of Congress, long enough so that they can actually get something done, which is important because it takes a while for congressmen to be useful. It doesn't happen on day one.
So one of the things, one of the terms you use there actually probably goes some ways to answering a question I've got, because I know that you're on record as bipartisanship is necessary if we're to address climate change in any kind of meaningful way. And you use the term enduring a couple of times. And I think that's probably a key there, because if it's just let's say flavor of the month, depending on who's got this razor thin upper hand in Congress and in the White House, that's not going to endure. What we do one time is going to go away the next time, and so on and so forth. So am I on the right track here in terms of the necessity for bipartisanship?
Yes, there are two aspects to the need for bipartisanship, apart from the obvious fact that that's how things are supposed to work. And in recent times, we may have forgotten that. The first issue is that partisan legislation, by its very definition, means that it's meeting the criteria of only one side of the aisle, which means that it might be climate legislation. It might be there to reduce greenhouse gas emissions or any other form of pollution for that matter. But unfortunately, it will also have to include aspects of that bill that meet all of the requirements of one party, which means it's got to be almost unanimous to get it through. Almost unanimous. Right. You maybe lose one or two votes. But by definition, by the time you've done that, that is not a great piece of legislation. That is a piece of legislation. The fact that then that it gets passed, and it's probably not a great piece of legislation, it really sets it up with a target on its back. And the likelihood is that there will be multiple court challenges, and the other side may, in fact, try to repeal that legislation, which is not a good use of legislators' time. So that's the first problem. The second issue is that legislation that's written on both sides of the aisle is likely to be better by its very nature. It's likely to be more representative of the entire country, and have it doesn't therefore need every single member of one party to pass it. In fact, it can be passed with a majority of the House, which means there can be quite a lot of people dissenting, particularly those on the extremes of either party who feel very strongly about one or other aspect of this, which may have nothing to do with climate change. So you're likely to get much more centrist, much more solid legislation. And then thirdly, when you have both sides of the aisle are working on it, you simply have more people working on it. One of the great problems with legislation is somebody has to write it. Interns are somewhat overworked in that capacity, and we use a lot of C3 organizations to actually write legislation. So getting more people involved is good because you're likely to have more people working long hours to write a reasonably good piece of legislation, which is also important.
Well, everything you say there makes total and complete sense. And I look around right now, and what is the possibility that we're actually going to get there? Well, let's start taking a peek at the 118th Congress. I mean, it looks like majorities are going to be razor thin on both sides with a split Congress. So how's that going to work?
Well, there are two worlds here. There's the world of the Twitter sphere, and there's the regular business of the House, or both houses, for that matter. It is true that we have passed less legislation recently than we have historically, although arguably that's not necessarily a bad thing. But nonetheless, there are very high profile bills and issues which find a lot of airtime, and there's a lot to argue about, and people can take very strong positions on. While all of that is happening, there are hundreds of bills that pass through the House during the year, which nobody takes the slightest bit of notice of. The trick going forward for this Congress is that we have two huge bills that were passed in the last Congress. They're going to take a while to digest. There's an awful lot of work to do for both houses. A lot of it is going to be allocating funding to things, and we can come back to the necessary issue of funding things. But certainly, there's an assumption now that to get the benefit, to exploit and facilitate the investments that have been made from the IRA and the Infrastructure Act, there's a ton of small bills that need to be passed, whether that's permitting or there's 100 other things that we need to do. But those smaller bills actually don't garner so much interest. And I think the trick to bipartisanship and the trick to getting anything through the House in particular is going to keep it small and keep it technical because it won't get any interest. And I think there's a good appetite to do that. But we're not going to see anything major. And nor should we, because we've just had two absolute whompers. So that's probably normal at this point.
So just a quick check. You use a term something like when you have really thin margins that it's difficult to get what I believe you call great legislation. So if I'm not misquoting you there, is the IRA 2022, is that great legislation or not?
It's not great from a certain point of view. Obviously, it is a huge step forward. I wouldn't want to remove anything from the achievement that was made, but it is largely incentive. The thing that Congress is very good at is spending money, and it's actually quite good at spending money we don't have. There is a case that the IRA is could be described as quote unquote neutral in this space, but in the end, it's incentive. The challenge with incentives is that they can be spent well or spent poorly, and it doesn't fundamentally change the landscape for addressing climate change in the way that we're facilitating, for instance, the free market or dealing with some of the regulatory hurdles that the country faces. And so the next role for that piece of legislation will be to allocate funding, particularly around infrastructure. It will be to make sure that the agencies have the correct brief for how that money is deployed correctly, to make sure that the development projects that are funded within it are spent wisely. There's a good deal of congressional oversight that will be needed. There's a lot of work to do. It's the beginning of something, not the end of something. And it's also at the limit, the absolute limit of what we can do with incentives. We can't do any more incentive at this point.
So just listening to you describe that, I think that we can anticipate, and I'm just checking this out to see if this is true, we can anticipate a lot of struggles, even around those smaller bills that you're referring to around spending, because there are a lot of states that think that the money that stuff is earmarked for is a waste of money.
Yes, I think that's probably true. I think it's true that people think that. Allocating and funding things. Let's just review what happens with money. When we create a bill, particularly when there's money behind it, it has to be given to an agency. That part, by the way, is not always clear in the bill. You have to decide which agency is responsible for executing how that money will be spent or that incentive will be spent. And then, believe it or not, you have to go back and allocate money to it. You have to fund it. And if you go back to the 2020 energy bill, Manchin and Murkowski arguably put together, it took a long time to get it funded. And often legislation sits on the books with no funding and no agency mandate for years. Mm-hmm. So nothing happens because it's not funded. So you can expect what you might call congressional oversight. You can expect a lot of funding issues to be worked through. And that's an entirely appropriate thing to happen because each state is a state and it has to work out for itself how it's going to allocate and spend that money, which is entirely appropriate. And if we don't do this, it is sure to be wasted. Alongside those funding decisions, then, are going to be other small bills that facilitate the correct spend. And a good example is permitting. If we don't address the permitting in the many ways that it needs fixing and addressing, we're going to spend money unwisely. Mm-hmm. And it will get spent nonetheless, but we have to go alongside that and provide and facilitate that spend with new legislation and new and agency mandates. They need to be redirected to do things in different ways. So there's quite a lot of work to do, and it's done in committee, and it's done by hardworking members of Congress, none of which I suspect use Twitter.
Yeah, so I think I'm picking up a theme that may be a new understanding for me, and I just want to check that out. So my perception is that Congress is largely not that interested in climate change. They're a lot more interested in other things like crime, inflation, the future of our democracy, things like that. So is it possible that when Congress is actually doing the work that you just referred to, that there are significant numbers of people in Congress who recognize the problem of climate change, and although they may be reluctant to talk about it in public, recognize that problem or are willing to do some work on it? Is there anything to that perception?
Yes, I can comment on that perception. We run a PAC, so I don't lobby, but that doesn't mean I don't spend quite a lot of time talking to members of Congress. And I've lobbied as a citizen as well, and as you know, been part of a grassroots organization doing the same thing. My experience to date is I've really only ever met one member of Congress who really, truly didn't believe that climate change was a serious problem and it wasn't anthropogenic. Mm-hmm. Everybody else I run into has got varying views on how serious it is and how we should deal with it. But here's the real rub. It sort of doesn't matter what the member of Congress actually believes. They are there to represent their constituents. This probably applies to Republicans slightly more than to liberal Democratic politicians. But ultimately, if the constituency believes that climate change is a problem and needs a solution, then the representative believes that climate change is a problem and needs a solution, because their polling data tells them very clearly that if they put something in front of their voters and vote for it, they'll get reelected. And they are single-minded seekers of reelection, and we should never forget this. So sentiment of their district is absolutely an essential part of this, and you will see them work together on that basis because the sentiment is changing.
So in terms of that sentiment, the Yale Climate Communication polls the nation regularly on issues like attitude towards climate change. And it's pretty clear that there's quite a marked difference between, let's call them, liberal and conservative points of view amongst voters on climate change. So why such a disparity of views between those two philosophical approaches?
If I may provide a bit of context first, I think the Yale material is actually a survey.
Fair enough.
But this is quite important, because if you take the survey into a member of Congress, it's not going to be treated particularly seriously. It's not a poll in the way that a poll tells the member of Congress whether they're likely to be primaried or not in 18 months' time or make it through the next general election. So the survey is interested in aggregate, but it isn't the sort of thing that would change anyone's behavior. The next, I guess, point about this is the survey suggests that this thing ranks, that the issue of climate change or the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions ranks in people's minds as a priority. But there's a paradigm here which is probably needs challenging. The fact that it ranks differently as a priority doesn't mean it's going to not get addressed. It simply means that certain people believe that the defense of the realm is of the nation is more important, or crime is more important, or, you know, pick your topic. It's on the agenda. If we measure it as is it in the top three or the top 20, is not a good indicator as to whether anyone's going to do anything about it. Okay, so we should be careful with that information.
And this makes me think about a lot of the popular media. They're looking for a grabbing headline, and a lot of the stuff that they're reporting on is more dramatic than it probably deserves to be, if you dig in and look closer at the thing. It sounds like an aspect of that same thing that that we can. I mean, the media really loves controversy, and you know, if they can make distinctions that grab people's attention. I read the other day something like that, that if a reader or of a user of the internet finds something that brings up angry feelings for them, they're going to stick with that, and so, and the media knows that. So
I don't disagree. It is a shame that our politics is heading in this direction. It's a shame that climate change is caught in the crosshairs of what is actually a much bigger challenge.
Yeah.
Because it's a systemic problem that's going to span decades, and it's an incredibly complex problem to solve. Not particularly complex to understand, in my opinion, but complex to solve. And so playing this out in the Twitter sphere is not going to be useful. The upside, though, is that my observation of members of Congress in both houses on both sides of the aisle is that there's an awful lot of work that does happen behind closed mm-hmm. doors. And in fact, in the open, it's not secret, but how many people really sit on C-SPAN and listen to debates or sit in committee meetings and watch the WP work through a new mandate for the EPA? It's pretty boring stuff, but you'll notice that the member is sitting there for 3 hours working through it. So there is work that happens. It does get done.
Yeah. I'm smiling to myself because the thought just occurred to me. It's like, you know, Ian might start restoring some of my faith in our political system from this perspective. So let's take a look, if we could, at the 118th. You've mentioned several times that there's going to be lots, ideally, there'll be lots of smaller chunks of legislation. So what are some of the areas that you think that the 118th Congress is going to be paying attention to in that regard? Now, of course, you've already mentioned, okay, where are we going to spend the money from the IRA 2022, which is going to be a big part of it. What else could we be looking for?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think there's an overarching theme that I would point to first before looking at specific bills. One of the challenges with renewable energy, or as we might describe the transition to a zero carbon or extremely low carbon energy future, is that there's a vast amount of technology that needs to be both developed and deployed. It's not just public sentiment that needs to change. There's actual real work to do to our mm-hmm. grid. Legislation is part of this. We do need further legislation to help develop that. But most of that legislation is about deploying money for development projects. And by development projects, I mean developing, for instance, small-scale nuclear reactors, or trying to work out how, when people talk about the smart grid, what does that actually mean? And who is actually going to do the really hard engineering work to figure out how to manage that grid and deal with the fiendishly difficult way of costing and allocating costs across the varying regions that we have in the US with this cooperative structure we have for our grid, which, by the way, is 100 and something years old now. I mean, these things, you know, these arrangements are old and they need reworking. So what we're going to see is twofold. We're hopeful we're going to see money poured into development projects, more of them, so that science and engineering can take its rightful place in leading this transition. I think we're going to see the change in mandates for some of our agencies. So they're quite literally given different marching orders, which is extremely important because they're operating on old marching orders. And that will throw up the need for new legislation that makes things either mandated or facilitates something that needs to happen. And I think it'll be in that order that things are done.
So when we look at greenhouse gas emissions, one of the things that I picked up researching what BCA does is comments about growing the economy, good jobs, and energy independence. So flesh those out for me a little bit. What are we talking about here?
Well, let's start with the economy. During the Obama administration, there was a report worked on at length, which tried to work out what sort of energy we're going to need in the future. And broadly speaking, to massively simplify it, by 2030, the report suggested that we would need roughly about twice as much energy as we do at the point the report was written. It won't surprise you to know that we're not on track for that.
Right.
So in terms of growing the economy, if we don't increase our energy at an affordable rate, the economy is going to suffer. If, however, we do invest in our technology, in our new economy, our new energy economy, the economy will grow substantially. Energy is going to be the game in global geopolitics for the next 50 years, because we are completely energy dependent. Mm-hmm. And so upgrading our energy infrastructure is essential to that. And renewables are have demonstrated that they're the cheapest form of energy. So this is a bit of a no-brainer, really, for any junior economist to work their way through. In terms of jobs, I'll take the nuclear industry as an example, although it's not really an industry anymore, but it used to be. And not everybody's in favor of nuclear, but it is relatively zero carbon. For that to work, for us to have a nuclear fleet that is likely to provide a big portion of our zero carbon future, we're going to need tens of thousands of young nuclear engineers. So we've got some work to do, and we've got some investment to, in short order now to grow an industry that has been allowed to decline. And again, these sorts of investments are the sort of things that governments can do that will spur good jobs, if you like. And I think that's a very important aspect of going forward. Now, there was a third one in there. You'll have to remind me.
Energy independence.
Oh, energy independence. Well, I think that's, it depends. We have gone through a globalization moment of since the Second World War, ramping up in the late 1990s and into the 20s here, which is now in receding for a variety of reasons. And in some ways, you could argue we've spread it too thin. Our energy drives our economy, and it makes us secure. We've solved it temporarily by fracking, but it isn't really a long-term solution. A long-term solution is renewables. True energy independence comes from renewables, and we're perfectly capable of building that future. So we need to be very clear about the motivations for building a green energy system. Energy independence should be at the heart of that argument.
It seems that when I hear energy independence talked about, mostly it's like, well, we shouldn't be exporting fossil fuels. We should be seeking more fossil fuels. So is there a perception that needs to change there about what energy independence means?
I think energy independence does mean different things to different political persuasions, I think is part of the challenge. Like I said, I think we have solved the energy independence. Most people would say we want to be energy independent. We weren't. We broadly are now about this point, maybe a year or two ago, as a result of a fracking revolution. But we've solved the problem on a temporary basis. I think that when a conservative talks about energy independence, they're concerned about our geopolitical position. Mm-hmm. And so much so that fossil fuels might well be an acceptable trade for some time. I think when somebody from the left-hand side of the aisle talks about energy independence, it may mean different things, and it probably doesn't play into the geopolitical fears quite as much, but certainly would be willing to reduce fossil fuels at the expense of that independence. Nonetheless, I think the reality for most presidents is once they sit in the office, energy independence is right on the desk, right in front of them the day they arrive.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going away.
Let's break there for a week. We'll pick up the second half of the conversation with Ian Harrison in the next episode. In the meantime, I hope you're finding lots of value in this conversation as I am, especially appreciating the possibility that Ian speaks of regarding folks from the left and the right finding spaces where we can agree about our climate and environmental futures. Things like a strong economy, good paying jobs for American families, and perhaps most important of all, being secure in our supply of energy. And I would say that the further we look into the future, the more clear it becomes that energy security is going to come from what we can gather and produce here at home, rather than what we have to import from across the sea. Next week, we'll be listening to the second half of Mr. Harrison's perspective on not only the value of bipartisanship, but the necessity of it if we are to adequately address the challenges presented by climate change. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out. A bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached to join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats, and always live like the mountain is up. Take care now.